All right, welcome everybody to the Joint Venture and Co-GP Strategies webinar. My name is Richard C. Wilson from the Family Office Club, and we're covering this topic because there's been a lot of business getting done between Family Office Club members who are sponsors, investment firms or that run investment funds, as well as between family offices and independent sponsors. And business is getting done through joint venture and co-GP strategies every day. And I think this topic is really not addressed enough by us. And I think a lot of people don't know how to approach their first joint venture deal. So I wanted to provide this webinar. It's just an introduction to the topic. We have a guest that's going to be joining us just a few minutes. We're going to be interviewing her, as you probably saw in the invite for this webinar. She's going to provide some case studies of real negotiated deals that she's been through. And then I'm going to go through a couple other case studies from within the Family Office Club that are happening in real time. We're going to cover a few insights or mistakes to avoid, and then we're going to take questions. We're going to take questions at two different times. First of all, you can submit your question anytime, but really after the interview with our guest, we'll be taking a few questions directly for her. And then we'll be taking a few questions at the end. We'll really try to get this done in 1 hour for the total content. I know I've been going over on some of them because we don't want to shut it down and just ignore 40 questions we have from people that were on the line and bothered to submit the question. But we're going to try to cap this one at 1 hour for today. So I hope you will enjoy the content here. I want to go into, first of all, a little bit on the Family Office Club. If this is your first experience with us, we have met with well over 2,500 family offices in person. I started the organization in 2007. And we've had over 1,000 ultra wealthy investors and family offices and private investors speak on stage at our 140 live events. And we've also done 35 of these recorded webinars. We've done many virtual discussion panels, which we do every week now. We also every day record and upload a investor mandate interview, which is a 7-minute interview with an investor on exactly what they're looking to invest in. A few of the 65 investor mandates we've recorded now are exactly on co-GP investing. And then we also have done about 7 or 8 member spotlights of active members within the Family Office Club to share what they're doing with others. One of those was with our guest, Meg Epstein. So maybe some of you have seen that. If you're not familiar with our offering, essentially we offer 130 plus proven capital raising strategies to our members, as well as access to the virtual investor discussion panels. Those are not public, as well as access to the recorded versions of all of our 30 plus webinars. Otherwise, you're only getting half of the recorded webinar, or some of them are not public at all. We also give quarterly pitch deck coaching and deal analysis, access to investor leads, and basically access to those investor mandates, which are recorded daily. The public versions of those don't have their last name, their firm name, or contact details. The version within the membership when you log in has all that information. On the homepage of familyoffices.com, you can see the types of mandates we have within the portal. So I'm not gonna read that over to you here now, just for time's sake. But during this webinar or at the end of it, if you want to join the membership, just go to familyoffices.com and fill out the form at the bottom of the homepage. If you love podcasts, we've got one called the Family Office Podcast. We have maybe 160 to 170 episodes on there now, and we're uploading 2 episodes every business day as our typical pulse. So that is growing quickly. We also have been at this for 13 years. So when we're providing the insights within the portal or within the webinar, it's really coming from what we see working in the industry, what's going well, who's getting momentum, what the smartest family offices are doing, what everyone's doing who's raising 10, 20 million or more in capital every year. That's what we're really trying to shine a light on so that everybody can make more efficient use of their time and be more effective, whether they're an investor or someone who is raising capital. Okay, so why talk about joint ventures and co-GP strategies? First reason is speed. It could be speed to getting to 100 million in assets, speed to getting to some level of credibility that you believe things will get easier at, speed at executing when maybe it's the right timing with a distressed investment opportunity, or maybe in a certain area, there's not enough inventory of a certain type of real estate. And if you're able to build and get that in place before others, they'll have an advantage. It could be focus. You might find that you're really great at development or securing or negotiating operating businesses for acquisition, or at aligning financing, or at running a company after it's been acquired. And you don't want to deal with the capital raising or the structuring. Well, that you could joint venture a co-GP with a few others to get more deals done by focusing on what you're best at. So that's one big advantage of a joint venture. A potential ROI, if you're focusing on only what you're best at and you're able to move faster, obviously the end result we're all looking for is a better result in terms of how much time we invest and money we invest and what we get in return. A lot of that comes down to momentum. What I mean by this is that if outsiders and your own team and your business partners just feel like you're not getting anywhere, you're going to lose their trust as a leader. So many times if you're not getting momentum, just opening your brain to the options is going to be something that's going to be beneficial by listening here today. Getting access to more deal flow, access to more investors, access to whatever your bottleneck is, and finding that joint venture partner that has all the access you can need in that area is another reason to consider joint ventures or a co-GP structure. And just to make sure everyone's clear before I jump into this, you might be buying one operating business, you might be buying a portfolio of real estate, you might be trying to raise capital for something small or very large. It doesn't matter which term you use essentially, but when you set up a joint venture, it's really trying to find parties that are complementary to your core skill sets. And co-GP is simply just saying that in the traditional investment structure of a GP finding the deal, structuring it and running the deal and bringing in limited partners to come into their general, to their general partnership offering essentially, then the limited partners have limited risk. They're not operating the asset. The general partner has more risk. They're putting some of their capital on the line at risk. And a co-GP deal is just saying that at the management of the deal level, you bring in one to two other parties to kind of joint venture on the project in a limited way, a very limited way, or a very broad and open way. Sometimes it's a 50-50 right down the middle partnership. Many times it has to be customized to what they're contributing and what's needed on that deal to be successful. I just want to make sure that is clear and kind of out of the way before we jump into too much of the content here. Okay, so the main point of today, I think will be interesting. Instead of just having me talk about and rattle off 20 different case studies, I kind of wanted to do a bit of an interview and a little bit more of a deep dive with one of our Family Office Club members. So I brought here on the line Meg Epstein. Meg, if you'd like to say hello for a second here.
Hi, everyone.
Great. And Meg is from CA South, which is a real estate development firm. And I'll let her describe it in the most accurate way possible here in 1 second. But we've gotten to know her through our live events and just being part of the community over time. It's impressive she's been able to build the operation that she has in such a short amount of time. And unlike a lot of people who go to high net worth investors and then jump up to going to the ultra wealthy, she kind of went straight to the ultra wealthy, but also used joint venture and co-GP deals to get there. And since she's gotten more momentum than probably 90% plus of members in the Family Office Club within just the first 3 to 5 years of their business, I thought she'd be a great person to have here to interview. So Meg, why don't we have you just give a little bit of background on CA South, maybe what's been key to your success, and a little bit about your value add process so people understand the type of business you're really in.
Sure. I say that we're a vertically integrated real estate development company and investment management. So we have a private equity fund as well as use various partners. So we'll go into, the exact structure with co-GPs or LPs, but it's definitely been part of how I've been so scalable. We focus on niche asset classes, kind of boutique size deals in Nashville. We have over $225 million. The project's underway at this time, and we've been at this for about 5 years in Nashville. And I originally came from California, kind of brought a perspective to the Southeast from the coast. And I really appreciate Richard having me on. When I hadn't raised any money, I went to one of Richard's conferences in 2016, I think it was, in New York. So I've taken a lot of the principles and applied them.
Great. And I guess you're not focused on one niche asset class, but you are focused, at least for now, on deals in one location on Nashville and the surrounding area. Can you talk about that just a little bit on that approach and whether you think it's helped you or hurt you, or how investors respond to not being niche in an asset class, but niche to a location?
Sure. I think on the co-GP basis, it's really helped to know to know the market, like the back of your hand, especially in a smaller market like Nashville. It's a very small real estate community, and most of the deals I get come off market. And so it's helped that I've focused on that market. It's also been sort of the darling of, you know, investment in the last year or two. So it has been relatively easy to raise money in Nashville. A lot of, you know, bigger investors in New York or Chicago, you know, these type of places are interested in placing money in Nashville. People love coming to visit Nashville and any excuse to come see it. And so that's definitely been an advantage. I think it helps to know the market very well. On the fund side, I think a more institutional investor could see it as, it can be perceived as unfocused. And in my case, I've leveraged, you know, my board and consultants and professionals and my co-GPs to really fully, you know, get to know the asset class and be able to perform well in it.
Okay. And out of all the deals you've done, can you talk about what is that total number of deals and how many of those you used a joint venture or a co-GP, you know, approach?
Sure. So we are at, we're at 12 deals now, three of which are still in the, we haven't broken ground on yet, but in the preliminary stages. Of those 12, four were done as with either my private equity fund as the LP or the opportunity zone projects. We tend to do more with LPs. So five of those deals have been with co-GP structure.
Okay, great. And then can you give us an example or two, maybe two case studies of joint venture or co-GP deals that you put together, or maybe somebody helped you in either sourcing the deal or sourcing some of the investor capital or some sort of a partnership going into it that otherwise you might not have gotten that deal completed?
Sure. I'll give you the very first co-GP I did and the very last one.
Sure.
It's a good range. The first project was 77 unit residential mixed-use building in very close to downtown Nashville. The first thing I did was get control of the deal, and it was a very solid deal in terms of returns. And my track record wasn't as developed in Nashville at that point. And so what I first did is I got control of the deal and put together a package, and then I started interviewing co-GP partners. And, you know, I went to various, you know, networks, and the partner that I ended up doing my first deal with, I found through CCIM, which is mm-hmm. a certified commercial investment member, right. Which has been a great program that I've gone through. And they were based in Michigan, but they were looking to deploy, you know, get into the Nashville market again, exciting a market for a lot of people. And so they saw the deal and came and toured the project. And we basically, once they decided they wanted to do it, which was, you know, very short turnaround, thankfully, because I think the merits of the deal were strong enough. They interviewed me, they interviewed my development partners, my architect and builder, and then so set it up in a pretty typical co-GP structure where we split the development fees, the principal of the fund signed on the debt, when he had a much bigger balance sheet than me at the time. And then basically it was my first co-GP deal. So I didn't realize it was interesting, but he had put a very high preferred return on it because it was our very first deal together. And instead of having a typical waterfall split, he did a high return. And then I got 100% of the promote after the pref. And
right.
And he did that to de-risk his own return. And that deal ended up being a 78% IRR. So I ended up making about twice the amount that he did, even though he put in all the money and
right.
on all the debt. But, you know, that's just the way it goes sometimes, right? And
he
had a more guaranteed return and I took more risk, but it ended up being, he didn't know that at the time. We still joke about it. But I think in that case, that one went so well. I think we're on our fifth project with that one partner now. We have about $125 million together. So I can get into, you know, the lessons
yeah.
I learned from that later, but that was pretty much a good template for us, and we kind of have
sure.
do it from that same. Yeah.
Sure. And what would be the some insights we could share, I guess, on that one? I think getting your first deal done has to be by far the hardest or most intimidating for those who are listening and trying to get that done. What would you say to guide people so they don't waste as much time? You know, obviously you are open to the different types of terms because that's an unusual arrangement, but it turned out in your favor, even though it might have seemed like somewhat vulture-like or very protective from the investor's point of view. The deal went so well, it actually went better for you than it did for them, but it went great for both of you, obviously, and they came back and invested with you again. But related to terms negotiation and just getting someone to take you seriously when you're in your first deal, do you have any suggestions on helping people get traction there?
Sure. I think the merits of the deal have to be, I would put your best deal forward and really test it. And you know, you can get professional opinions from your mentors or, you know, but really do your own due diligence and make sure the deal can stand on its own and put your best deal, because that's how you're going to start a relationship that gets repeated. Especially in this climate, people want good deals. The second thing I think that is important is you want to choose partners with complementary skill sets, not someone with a similar skill set. So obviously I hadn't raised, you know, $9 million before, and he had, and really, you know, technically dependent, usually the person providing the capital in a co-GP wants control. And, you know, if you're the boots on the ground, you don't necessarily want someone that's going to be helping you, you know, choose the finishes or something like that, or wants to be involved, you know, in the day to day. And so it's helped, because in that case, that person, that my partner, was pretty removed, and he has the power to take control if he needs to, but he just never really has. And it's kind of a nice, it feels more like an LP relationship. So I would say, you know, you want to choose partners that have complementary skill sets to yours and not the same, where, you know, that could lead to, you know, where you're kind of easily divisible, you know, dividing tasks.
Right. And since that deal is a $9 million capital need, having done smaller and larger deals since then, I would assume, do you have any comments on the size of the deal? Some people say bigger deals are easier to get done and you make more money. Others, you know, say, well, get momentum, do a small $1, $2, $5, $9 million deal before you try to do some $50 or $100 million deal. Do you have any feedback if anyone here is swinging really big on their first deal, or any feedback on what's too small or too big to be worth it or to be credible on your first deal?
Yeah. I always tell people that I'm giving away my secret and just thinking big enough, but I think it's just people can't conceptualize doing a $30 million deal to start, but it really is easier, you know, than, and you can say people that, you can tell people that over and over, and they just can't think with really doing it. So I don't worry about anyone competing in my market or something, but it's just, right. It really is easier, much easier, about at $10 million to find investors. Now, are they going to give someone $10 million that has no track record? No, but I also leverage relationships on the sponsor side. My architect builder, you know, he was a development partner essentially, and he had done this for a couple decades before. I brought in another local developer in Nashville that had been integral in developing Nashville over 40 years, and he was involved in the sponsor side as well, just to, you know, have some gray hair. So you have to give away maybe more of your deal, but you need to bring in, you can essentially offer people equity to get an A team together that has the track record. And that's what this is all about. What we're talking about is co-GP and finding partners and, you know, scaling up quicker because you can leverage other people's assets.
Right. Great. What about a second case study? Is that you had one that was more recent?
Sure. So the lesson I learned there was to launch the mixed use platform. That was the way I did it, and it worked really well, obviously, for me. So I did the same thing in Nashville. I originally focused on a product type and a boutique size investment, and the same thing led me into industrial, which was looking at the data, looking where the niche asset classes that were not being served by bigger developers. And I saw the need in the market, but And it was below 3% vacancy, it was a no-brainer. So I wanted to do the same thing that I did with the other strategy, and I found a good deal. I started calling the brokers in the space and getting to know the industrial market. I found a great deal. Same thing, interviewed co-GPs, went on LinkedIn, various networks, looked for the best institutional level industrial developers. And I found one that was really interested, again, to break into the Nashville market. And, maybe it would help other people that aren't in such a market that's so trendy at the moment, like Nashville, but maybe it would help people to interview people more locally or something. But the point is, you have to get control of the deal, because then, you know, someone is interested in partnering with you.
Right.
And so in that case, so this was an industrial, which is quite different than mixed use. And so I, chose a partner that's been doing this for 40 years very successfully. And we did the same thing, delineated responsibility. In industrial, there's a lot more of the due diligence process. It takes a lot, it's much more expensive and extensive to figure out land zoning and those type of things. So we pretty much decided, I'd be the boots on the ground. I had the deal. They would provide the debt and equity. And in this one, again, we split the developer fee. And the GP side of the equity contribution is also split, and they provide, the LP capital at 7% with the LP in this one, and we split the promote above the LP.
Right, okay. What about locking up, especially on the first property? What do you do to lock these up? You simply put them under LOI, and then you have a clock on your back for finding that co-GP partner, and maybe you kind of soft circle the teaser version before you hard lock it up? Or what does that look like? Because we have a question about that in the chat stream I saw.
Yeah, to be honest, when I first did it, I was a bit more off the cuff, and I just brought I'd shown the idea to the investor, and I trusted him enough, and technically I guess he could have gone around me, but he didn't. But I would recommend, definitely, if you can, it's been, especially in this current climate, maybe it's not so much of a seller's market where people, I know about other places, but in Nashville, sellers want you to close on a $10 million parcel in 90 days now. And maybe that's loosened up more recently, I hope. But if you can get 120 days of due diligence, or at least, especially on a ground up deal, or, in real estate, try to get enough due diligence of a runway, but also do your own research now if you know what kind of asset class you're going to focus in. If it's in apartments, then see who's really active in that area in the type of projects you want to be in, and do a lot of research before, so that way when you have your deal, you know who to go to. And if it's a good deal, it shouldn't take more than a month or two to get some, fairly down the line if it's going to get funded. Sure.
Okay. And are the GP partners of yours requiring you to put up 5 to 10% of the capital, and then they'll bring in the rest of that capital, or are they not requiring you to put up any capital?
No, we usually put in capital. Okay. But it's not as much as people would think. It's a negotiable point. Sometimes we just cap it at a smaller percentage, but, as I've grown, it has, it's become less of a problem to put in 50% of the GP position or something. But in the beginning, if you get to know you spend enough time with the investor or your co-GP, and they get to know you and they trust you, then you'd be surprised at how flexible people will be.
Right. That's good to know. Okay. What about, we had a question here about IRR expectations. If it's an opportunity zone deal versus not, do you see a big difference between return expectations when it is qualified as an opportunity zone and it's structured to take advantage of that?
Yes, I don't underwrite any tax benefits into my IRRs, and I think people appreciate that. But I think that most people, especially in this environment, are still looking at high teens over a 10-year hold, which can be tough to accomplish. Now, I tend to be really conservative. I think I'm too conservative in my underwriting because my projects don't, where they're placed in Nashville or, you know, a mile from Amazon, and I'm not accounting for huge appreciation that we've seen in the market. Mm-hmm. But I think high teens IRRs for ground up development is just what's expected even across a 10-year hold. I don't think people will get there at 12 or 14.
Right, right. And do you see during this virus kind of crisis, for those listening live and not, you know, a year or two from now, do you see a big change in Nashville, not just in deals getting done? Obviously, I'm guessing less deals are getting closed every week there, but on pricing yet, do you see any changes? Are there any adjustments in either strategy or execution that you and your team have made since the beginning of March?
Sure. I haven't seen a big, I mean, we've had, I point to two projects that I was actually surprised to see close $250 million loan on a very large mixed use project a couple weeks ago, high rise luxury hotel project went forward, as well as a land parcel for about 1.4 acres for $35 million for a hotel site. So those all went through. I was going, wow, these people really have some guts. But so I haven't seen a huge adjustment. I think everyone's sort of on pause, but Nashville's just innately a bit of an opportunistic an optimistic place. And I think people think that by summer, this will all be over. I don't know. I can't imagine that things will just go back to normal. But I haven't seen that as much. For me, I was already, we had unbelievably got hit with a tornado a couple weeks before the virus. And so
right.
I was already very bullish on my industrial strategy because I'd watched the market and launched that with my partner the last year. And especially when the tornado came, I thought, well, we really need to increase, the supply is even less. So I think the industrial sector and multifamily are gonna be the preferred investment types coming out of this or for the next couple quarters at least. And so I think that's gonna be a big part of my focus, especially opportunity zone. I found there's one project on a co-GP basis that I've been working on funding, and I've gotten a commitment in the last just a few weeks of sending it out, and that's just because people in the long run think over 10 years Nashville is a good bet, so in multifamily. So
right, okay, yeah. And I think Nashville is known for being a strong healthcare city as well. I know, and obviously some parts of healthcare right now are busier than ever for bad reasons. So can we move on to then, I guess, some top insights you've gotten, some best practices or lessons learned from structuring co-GP deals?
Sure. I think, for the in the industrial space, for example, I think even as I've gotten bigger and had success and, raised my own private equity fund, and I still go back, and it's actually, I think a co-GP relationship is very beneficial, and it's how I started, and I'm still, it's probably the most successful thing that I've done to leverage. You're sharing, especially on the industrial side, you're sharing all your due diligence costs, which can be in the hundreds of thousands for one deal. And so if you have a strong co-GP partner that will share those with you, then that's a huge benefit. Also, in my case, I've relied on my co-GP partners to bring a lot of the debt and equity. And that takes a lot of time, as a lot of people here have probably spent, what we're doing in the family office club. I mean, it takes a lot of time to raise that. So if you can divide your time and be the person on the ground bringing the deal, or you're going to be the operator, then it's just, it's all about the scalability factor. And I think people, it's like you have to really look and go, okay, do I want to be the sole owner of one $10 million deal, or do I want to own 30 or 40% of $100 million in deals? And I think people, have to, you should, it's worth looking at, even though it can be some heartburn to give away so much equity sometimes. For
sure.
And then the other thing is it's just instant credibility. You know, I was not an institutional level industrial developer, for example, but working with, you know, a great partner, we've been able to gain that credibility. And then you also learn a lot from, you know, people that have had decades of experience doing it. And so those are the benefits. I think the main things that I would recommend is really just being clear about the roles and delineating that in the beginning. Fortunately, I haven't had a problem with that, but a lot of people have. And, you know, down to who's going to be responsible for investor reporting, or, you know, just really, really dive into the details with that, as well as fee structure and, you know, your developer fee. I mean, it's never been a problem for me, but developer fees can get paid in very different ways. It can be based on the amount of time or the amount of work done. And so, you know, if you're really depending on those, you have to work out with your partner what's fair. And then otherwise, it's just like anything, which is an experience in any business, is it's all about who you're, you know, who you're doing business with, and doing your own due diligence and building trust, and the basic, I think, the lessons that anyone learns in business and having partners, right?
Right. Okay. We have two questions from John and Richard here. And if anyone else wants to submit questions through the Q&A panel, it'll be easier to identify your questions if you can start submitting them there for Meg. John had a question about what is Promote, and then Richard had a question about the first case study you gave. If you can share a little bit on the breakdown of how that high preferred return structure looked like. I thought maybe both could be kind of addressed within one answer, perhaps, with that example of just like what a Promote is, and that example of what the numbers look like in that first deal, if you're able to share at some level of specificity.
Sure. So Promote, just think of it, I suppose, as the back end of the deal, the back end profit after the person that puts in, and I, it's so second nature to me, I'm sorry, I didn't clarify that before, but the person who puts in the money, so say you need $1 million for a deal, will usually want a preferred return. That's how I've seen every deal structured, so that they get paid based on the time their money is deployed. A typical return would be, you know, 8% on a mixed use project, for example. So that person's going to get $80,000 for every million they invest every year. And then what's left over is the back end profit that you're going to split up in different ways. And typically the money will want at least half of the back end profit. So that just gets given to whoever provided most of the money. And then the rest of the profit is split between you and your partners in various ways. Most of my deals have been about a 50-50 split with my partners. I think I've also been luckier in some cases. And as the deals get bigger, in more of an institutional quality, it's more like 20 or 30% of the back end is what you could expect. But then it's all relative. You're looking at $10 million in profit, so it's still worth it.
Right. Makes sense. Juan has a question about your partners. I know you mentioned Juan was from Michigan. Out of the five or more co-GP deals you've done, how many of those were local versus out of the state or out of the region?
Everyone was out of the state.
Okay, great. Another question here. What was her main reason for the co-GP balance sheet to support the recourse? If so, why does she still do it? When will she outgrow it? So I guess he's talking about the debt piece. You know, the reason for having them co-sign on the debt, I would guess it would make the bank more comfortable having that established capital partner or principal with a larger balance sheet. Is that why you use them on the debt, or can you go into a little bit more detail on that?
Well, if you're doing a co-GP structure, then, you know, you want the person, like, why not share the risk with the person that is getting the fees alongside you? I mean, that's one of the main benefits of it. I'm self-made. I'm, you know, in my mid 30s, I'm self-made. I'm doing $225 million worth of deals. It's not because my balance sheet's that big. So you have to leverage that, right? The other point is that, will I outgrow it? In the case of my first partner, we just have a great working relationship. It's not some big deterrent for me to co-GP because we have a great working relationship. We're five deals in, you know, we've never had a problem. And, you know, it's really, in the end, it really is about who you work with and, you know, are you enjoying it? Are you liking what you're doing beyond just returns, right?
Right, right. Well, we have a question here about getting copies of the webinar. We will have copies of the slide, the recordings. We usually just provide half of the recording to non-members. The full version will be inside the portal for members. If anyone's listening to this first half and they had trouble getting on for the live part at the right time, we're happy to give you the full version of this one. But we've got 30 plus webinars in the portal that are recorded full versions. So yes, we'll have this one recorded as well. Hurdle rates. And many times people use a 7-8% preferred return in development because maybe the returns are a little bit higher than what a cash flowing kind of C-class multifamily property might be, for example. What type of hurdle rates are expected within your space? Is it that 7-8 or 6-8% preferred return still? Or